Okay, maybe we could begin with where and when you were born.
Right, well, at the end of the First World War, my father, who was a veteran of the Canadian Army, was given a quarter section of land in a place called Grassy Lake. My mother was a school teacher, and that is what kept body and soul alive, because Grassy Lake neither had grass nor a lake. And although we lived in Grassy Lake, which is in southern Alberta, I was born in Lethbridge and lived in Grassy Lake until I think I was 5 years old. I was born in 1921. And in 1926, as it still had not rained in Grassy Lake, the family moved to west of Claresholm in southern Alberta, where my father had a ranch. And we lived on the ranch until I think I was 12 or 14 years old when we moved into a town where I could sort of complete my education by going to high school.
Is there any other family military background besides your father's? And what part of the service was your father in?
My father was in the cavalry. His brother was also in the Canadian Army in the First World War. They were Irish immigrants to Canada. My father had come to Canada before the First World War when he was 14. And had come out to stay with friends of the families at a place called Meadow Creek near Claresholm. People call him McKinnon. The sort of military aspect is really confined to my father's side. On my mother's side, there was one brother who was in the services but did not go overseas. And the others were either too young or they were medically unfit. Mm-hmm. So he was the only one.
After you finished high school, did you go to university?
Yes, I was able to get an IODE scholarship on the completion of high school. And as you may know, those were very difficult years across Canada, certainly in Western Canada. And I entered university on the scholarship in 1939 in a general arts course, and after the first year I switched to an honors history course in 1940.
And did you finish that before you joined the...
Well, when I switched to honors history, I was also able to join the COTC, the Canadian Officers Training Corps, and in 1941, my father had, with some connivance, re-enlisted in the Canadian Army as an instructor. Brigadier Harvey, who was the area commandant, was a very close friend of his. And I felt the urgings to, the compulsion to serve in the Canada's forces. And I understood that the Royal Edmonton Regiment was looking for reinforcement officers. And I went to the Dean of Arts and Science, Dean Smith, who was a veteran of the PPCLI in the First World War, and who was also second in command of the 2IC, and was my sort of mentor at university. And I told him I wanted to go active, and he complimented me, and he said, don't worry about your future. He said, there's an old Chinese proverb that goes that when rape is available, relax and enjoy it. And if you feel that you've got to enter the active army, he said, you have our blessing and all of our support. So in early 1942, the Edmonton Regiment offered to take a number of us, but only if we would join the ranks and go through a period of training in Curry Barracks. And from there, if we were of the right material, we'd go out to get our commissions at Gordon Head and Victoria, and then we could go as reinforcement officers. And I remember very much that I was interviewed by the Inspector General of Western Canada and General Griesbaugh, who was almost the father of the Loyal Edmonton Regiment, or the 49th Battalion, as it was more popularly known at that time. And he looked at my curriculum and he said, you regard yourself as being a historian. He said, when was the Hudson's Bay Company formed? And I said, sir, I can't remember. Well, he said, you're not a very good historian, but at least he said you're honest. And which stage I was marched out, but apparently I passed the interview. And the next hurdle was Brigadier Harvey. And when I appeared before Brigadier Harvey, he said, Dugan, he said, you're not Jack Dugan's son, are you? I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, how is your mother and how are your father? I miss seeing them so much. And that was the interview. So I left, I joined on the 25th of March, 1942, just before the, as it happened, just before the third year exams of a fourth year course. But indeed, the University of Alberta was very kind, and as Dean Smith had said, don't worry about your future, because some 6 or 7 months later, I received a degree, a BA, a past BA, in absentia, which I was very, very grateful.
I can imagine. How long were you? Did you serve as a private?
I think we were. We served. There were five of us, and I think all from the COTC. And we'd all actually qualified the COTC for our commissions. And we were given the NCO course at Currie Barracks. We were there from the 25th of March until we went out to Gordon Head in April. And we were Guppy's Mark 13 at Gordon Head on a 3-month course, and we graduated in July.
What sort of
1942?
What sort of training did the course consist of? At Gordon Head.
At Gordon Head. Well, it was training as second lieutenants, and I can't recall too much about it, except we had theory as well as good practical field training. We had a lot of drill. We lived in barracks,
the old H huts,
and we were certainly installed with military discipline. This had been also built into us during our NCO course in Currie Barracks. And when we went on our officers' training, we were given the, I think we were called cadet sergeants or acting sergeants. We were given some type of rank. And it was my first exposure, really, to being that far from home. And I must confess that I enjoyed every moment of it. They were a wonderful bunch of people. All of the cadets were roughly the same age. There was a number who had come back from overseas who were being commissioned from the ranks. There were a few of us who came from university. But they were drawn from all over Western Canada. And they were going to various regiments. And we did see quite a few of them, eventually, of our friends overseas.
Who were the instructors? Were they First World War veterans?
The instructors, many of the instructors, well, the many of the officers were First World War veterans, and also many of the senior NCOs were First World War veterans. But then, of course, they had brought back, and there were some other NCOs and some officers from the militia, or some who had gone overseas from the militia with the Canadian troops and had returned as instructors. And they were excellent people. Some instructors had been university professors or lecturers, and they weren't that much older than we were, and they were a very tolerant lot. I have very, very happy memories of our stay at Gordon Head.
And you left Gordon Head a lieutenant?
We left Gordon Head as second lieutenant.
That's the second lieutenant.
And we were then sent to Currie Barracks, again in Calgary, to get our second, as we call it, our second pip, to become full lieutenant. And when we graduated in Calgary, I remember very well the standing. As far as I can remember, the one who stood first was a chap named Basil Robinson, who had been chosen as a Rhodes Scholar from B.C. in 1940, and he later became Under Secretary of State for External Affairs and a very good friend. The number two, I think, was my very good friend of mine, Al Johnson, we had enlisted together, and we served together all through, during the war. And he'd been the platoon sergeant when I was in the COTC, and I think I stood number three. This was sort of more on the theory than on the, perhaps the physical prowess, but we all did fairly well at Currie Barracks. And then, of course, once we had finished Currie, we were then eligible to go overseas and join the regiment or go into a holding depot as reinforcement officers.
And when did you go overseas?
Well, all of us. The ones there were. May I give you the names of the ones?
Sure.
Because I think you've interviewed some already, and you may interview others. But the ones as far as the original bunch from the U of A who made it to Gordon Head and were commissioned. There was Al Johnson, Earl Christie, Jim Woods, Keith McGregor, and myself. That's five.
Great. Good.
I think so.
Yeah.
One chap, there being six, I suppose, I think had gone. One fell by the wayside. He didn't quite make it out. He wasn't quite mature enough to go out for his commission. And of those five officers, everyone eventually served with the Loyal Edmonton Regiment, and the two that served the longest with them were Johnson and myself. Christie, unfortunately, was killed in attack and sustain, which I was the other platoon commander. And Jimmy Woods, who is now a judge in Alberta, joined the regiment in Ortona, and I think was badly wounded the first or second day in the leg, and that was the end of him. And Keith McGregor joined the regiment after Al and I had joined in Italy, and he became one of my platoon commanders. And in fact, Al Johnson became my second in command eventually. And Keith stayed on in the services after the war and became a brigadier general. Of these five, he was the only one who became a permanent force officer.
After your training, did you feel prepared to be an officer? Did you feel that you were?
That is a very good question. I had not belonged to the militia. I had a great respect for the services through my father. But I was not a particularly warlike person, except that I had been very active in the outdoors as a youth and as a young man, fishing and hunting and horses and that type of thing were just second nature to me. But the ability and the art to command men, something that had to be acquired and learned, and I think the army was the army training was what was certainly instrumental in providing that very basic ingredient, and I must say that although I did have moments of doubt, like all young men, I think I had a lot of tremendous amount of confidence, and that's what carried the thing through. Because you see, I was quite young, and when I eventually joined the regiment, I found that I was almost, although I was a platoon officer, I was almost the youngest, one of the youngest men in the platoon. And when I became a company commander, I was the youngest company commander in the battalion. But the war aged people quickly through experience and through exposure, and I think one learned how to be firm, and yet I think you had to be tempered with compassion, and there was a basic understanding. We weren't very far removed really from the people that we were leading. Many of them came from absolutely the same backgrounds, and many were school friends of mine.
Were the relations fairly well? Did the ranks get along with the officers?
If an officer did his job, if an officer led his troops and provided for his troops and had the reputation of being fair, and if he had the reputation that he would fight the enemy, if you set an example, there was absolutely no problem. Your men would, I think, follow you anywhere, or at least 90% would. If an officer had the reputation of being a ditherer or a slacker or a coward, and we did have that type, and then the men got to know this very, very quickly, and that same relationship did not exist.
Were you eager to go overseas?
Oh, absolutely.
I guess everyone was.
I think everyone was. We didn't, you know, war. We came from Alberta. Times of being tough. I lived in Claire's home. A trip to Calgary was a big event. I'd never been to the Pacific Coast. I don't think hardly any of us had. The prospect of a trip across the Atlantic to England, and England was still regarded by us as the mother country, sort of the home away from home almost. It was a wonderful thing, and we'd never been exposed to the warmth of the reception we got in Britain during the war. We were young. We had money, not that much, but we were quite well off compared to the British soldiers.
How much were you paid as a lieutenant?
Well, I'm trying to think. It wasn't all that much. As a major, I think I got $10 a day. No, I didn't. I think I got $180 a month. $180 a month, so as a lieutenant. Oh, dear. I don't know.
Not very much.
Not very much, I don't
think. More than the British.
But more than the British. Not quite as much as the Americans. But we, you know, compared to speaking, we were quite well off. And we were accepted very much by the people in Britain. They still regarded us partially as, if not colonials, at least people from the Dominions. Canada at that stage did not have, despite the fact that we, as you know, eventually put 1 million people under arms and became the fourth largest producer of munitions and of equipment on the Allied side. We were still not regarded as being of the same caliber as the really developed European countries. We regarded as doing pretty well, you know, for sort of colonials.
What was your first impression of England and the English?
Well, we arrived in Scotland, and we were ushered onto a train, and I didn't really see and it was all very strange. And we went, I think our first camping, our first center was a place called Crookham Crossroads. And the first weekend, I think that Keith McGregor and I went off to London. And we were billeted, we still argue about this. I thought it was the Liberal Club, but he said it was the Reform Club. And London was in the blackout. And here were these old gentlemen, of my age now, reading their newspapers and putting up with us, but not being overly forthcoming. And but anyway, we went out that evening and we found that London, despite the blackout, despite the fact that they'd gone through the terribly severe bombing not long before, this was in the fall of 1942, that London was a gay place in the old sense of the term, a gay place beyond all of our expectations. And it was just an exciting and charming place.
Were you treated well by the local people, the British?
Oh, we were. I can never recall being humiliated or turned a cold shoulder by any Britisher. They were always helpful, always friendly, much more than now, I might say it.
And where were you stationed? Were you with the regiment or were you a
No, we were reinforcement officers.
Yeah.
And we were at, in this sort of camp under canvas, which wasn't too pleasant. And then I was seconded to the 48th Highlanders as an exchange officer with an Eastern regiment. And I was adopted more or less by the 2IC of the 48th Highlanders of Toronto, a chap named Jim Armstrong, who later became Agent General of Ontario in London. And he was the most impressive man, and that was a unique experience because he always took me with him. He was invited out to a number of country homes in the States, of course, in southern England, and he was a very sought-after guest, and he was invited, and he would take me with him. And that was my sort of introduction to polite English society. And I remember very well some of the stories he used to tell about attacks by wild boars in Ontario. And of course, it was a bunch of hogwash. And he'd say, "Isn't that right, Duke?" And I'd say, "Yes, yes." And of course, you know, these are all sort of figments of the imagination. But the British were drinking it in, you see. And it is what they expected in Canada. But I was able to serve with the 48 for 3 months. And then we returned and we were stationed in Aldershot. Aldershot was, the town itself had been, it had been immersed with soldiers from time, or overwhelmed with soldiers from time immemorial. So they knew how to cope with soldiers. But we'd all, you know, had our friends and friendships by that stage. And it wasn't too bad. And in the spring, things were stirring. And we were sent up to Scotland, still as sort of what they call first line reinforcements. Not all of us, there were just some of us. I don't know what happened to some of my colleagues, but I know I was stationed in a place called Barrhead in Scotland. And I was carried on strength of the regiment as a supernumerary, because there was no platoon to give me. And the regiment trained, and eventually we all sailed. And there was tremendous speculation as to where we were going. Some people thought the war in North Africa was either over or about to draw to a close. Some people thought we were going to the Far East. But anyway, when we reached the Med, the news was announced that we were in fact going to the invasion of Sicily.
How long had you been on board ship?
Oh, too long going down the Bay of Biscay. It was a terrible voyage. It's very rough there. And then we went through, I can't remember how long the voyage took, but it must have been several weeks. Because there were huge convoys. You see, there were the first, as you know, the first Canadian Division and the first Army Tank Brigade had been chosen to join the British 8th Army in the invasion of Sicily, but the initial plan was not to stay indefinitely. It was to sort of give battle experience and then to be pulled back. And there'd been some reluctance on the part of the British even to accept this because they didn't really require certain types of units. But the political decision was made that we would participate. And it was time because the 1st Division had gone overseas in 39. And it had, you know, we had guarded the coast of the South Coast for years. I had, during my time in England, of course, I had been with the regiment from time to time, too, as occasions arose.
We should talk a little bit about the training during that period, too, and how you
yes.
were prepared for the invasion.
Yeah, well, my own personal training was that we all did battle drill courses, and I guess you'd call them commando courses now, or whatever they call them. They didn't appear to me to be as rough as or tough or as heroic as you see on television now. In fact, you know, the actual war never seemed to me to be as rough and tough and as heroic as you see in the movies. But we had battle drill and we had junior leaders courses. We also participated in the various, we had these big schemes.
Spartan.
Yes, and you know, and we were not, although we were not with the regiment, we were moved to the second echelon, or we were umpires and that type of thing. So we were given, you know, quite good training. But I personally was not trained in the assault landing over a beach, as some of the as the people with our battalion were trained in Scotland prior to the invasion.
How was being a reinforcement different from being with the regiment? How would your life be different, your daily routine? Or
well, you didn't have the responsibility of having a platoon. you did various sort of chores, but you weren't really commanding men, unless you were an orderly officer, or unless you were given some task. But you were not given a designated unit to control. It was quite a bit different. You were part of, but not with, the unit.
Were you anxious to get in the unit?
Oh, very much so. That was our the whole aim of joining the regiment was to get with it. So when the invasion of Sicily took place, the invasion, you know, went in the morning. And we were landed, I can't remember who else, you know, went in as what they call a first line reinforcement. I think I was the only one of that original five who went ashore. There was another chap I remember, but he's, I don't know where he came from, Pritchard. And Jim Stone, Colonel Stone, was a captain, and he was a beach control officer. I remember that very well. And we went in the afternoon, and it was pretty safe. And we moved inland and to sort of a concentration area. And the great danger there was at night when the Germans did have some aircraft still, and they carried out, you know, raids on these great convoys, these great massive ships that were in the area of Pacino, where the invasion took place, or the landing took place. And we weren't terribly worried about them. What we were worried about was the the fragments from the anti-aircraft fire that was raining down, and there were quite a few casualties from this flak that was shot at, you know, this barrage that went up. Jesus, down it came. And, you know, you felt pretty small without having something over you with all this metal sort of raining down. Anyway, we moved up out of the area, and eventually, just after the Battle of Dien 40, the vacancy came up for a platoon commander in the Royal 11th Regiment, and I moved up. Earl Christie, this other chap, must have been, we were in the same group. Earl went up about the same time, and Earl went to number 15 platoon, and I went to number 16 platoon. I might mention Earl Christie, who was, as I said, killed later, had finished his fifth year. He was in his fifth year medical at the University of Alberta when he enlisted. He had a brilliant future ahead of him as a doctor, but he couldn't wait to qualify. He just wanted to get into the battle. So I joined the platoon just north of Dien 40 in Sicily.
It's one of the most dangerous jobs, isn't it, the platoon commander? I've heard that and corporal were the
largest amount
of casualties.
Yeah, I think so. The smallest unit is the section. At least during the Second World War, the smallest units were the section. And the next smallest unit was the platoon. So I always felt that the job of the platoon leader was to lead, not to stay behind and direct his his sections, because sometimes you're only directing 10 or 12 men, because platoons were never up to strength. So we had a lot of casualties of platoon commanders, and certainly a lot of casualties of corporals and lance corporals.
Where was the first real opposition you encountered?
Well, just after I joined D Company. It was commanded by Major Bury, who was a veteran of the First World War, and the battalion had been given the task of sending a company behind the German lines at Ajira, 6 or 7 miles behind the lines, to cut the road from the north going into Ajira, which was then to be attacked by the 2nd Brigade. And Ajira being on, you know, one of the main axes of advance. And I was given the task of being the lead platoon in the company, the D Company, to do this. And it was a night infiltration. I was very lucky. I had a Sergeant Hamill, we called him, Wolf Hamill. I think he was from the First World War also. He was an older man. He was a man who dispensed quick and rough justice where it was required, and was known as a tremendous sort of fighter. And he had a lot of savvy and know-how. He was a tremendous strength. Anyway, we
by a compass and map, we were able to infiltrate the German lines, getting very, very close. That we, in fact, you know, could hear them talking very clearly, I suppose. We were not more than 15 or 20 yards away, their defensive positions. And we got in behind them, and then we got back as far as their artillery positions, and when dawn broke, I could see, it was pretty rough going, mind you, and we were never quite sure exactly where we were. The rough of the ground was terribly badly broken. Sicily's a terrible place to maneuver. It's very desolate and rocky and dry and mountainous. Water was always a problem. Terribly thirsty. Terrible, terrible. You had to be very careful. The water, not that it was poison, but whether it was, you know, really drinkable. And then you had to be careful of the mosquitoes and so forth. There was a lot of malaria.
Is that a common ailment?
Oh, yes. Malaria and the jaundice and dysentery was rampant. When the dawn broke, we could see our objective, which was this road alongside quite a steep mountain, and we were to put a block in the road. But unfortunately, there was no sign of the remainder of the company. In fact, there'd never been any sign of them. So we had no communication. We were too far in for our sets to work with the rugged terrain to communicate with the battalion. So we pushed on and we got to this road junction. And as we got there, unfortunately, there were several, three or four German trucks were coming from the north. And, there was a firefight. I when they fired their first burst of fire, I thought it was some type of insects. I hadn't heard this before. I heard this crack around your ears. Sounded a bit like bees, and then suddenly I realized what the hell it was. Sure move in those conditions. So we dispensed with them, and then we saw quite a major German formation coming from the south. So I thought we should carry out some redeployment, but before we were able to do that, a German tank came around the corner. There was some infantry on it. I swear his gun was 50 feet long. And he saw us, and I suppose the range wasn't more than 25 yards. And the Piet man fired and missed, which is pretty awkward since we had nowhere to go. That damn big gun was swimming around. And the Piet man reloaded and fired standing with tremendous fortitude, and he hit the tank just at the turret ring. And it jammed the gun. It dispensed with the infantry that were riding on the tank, and then we tried to drop grenades in the hatch, the open hatch, but our aim wasn't too good, and the tank could have pulled back and just went around the corner and blew up. But I felt at this stage that our position had been revealed. The whole sort of countryside was, we were back 6 or 7 miles behind the line, but the whole countryside was swarming with, as far as I could see, uniformed of the wrong shade. So we mined the side of the road, the gravel side of the road, and carried out a strategic withdrawal, tactical withdrawal, a little bit better positions. I suppose we marched within 100 yards of German formations, but they thought that we were German, and we didn't do anything to dispel that thought. And we took quite a few people. We ran into some of them. We couldn't avoid them, so we took them prisoner. And one group we took prisoner, they had 3 Canadians prisoner, an artillery captain and his NCO and wireless operator. So we reversed the procedure with them. And we withdrew about a quarter of a mile, and we met a runner from battalion who had a message that I was to hold the road at all costs. If I was on the road, I was to hold it at all costs, that the rest of the company had not been able to join me. But that evening, C Company was going to be sent through. So we turned around and trudged back, taking more prisoners to the road. We got to the road, and I think there was another tank knocked out, track, you know, had been blown, and there was a couple of half tracks knocked out, and a truck. And I remember one of the half tracks was loaded with cherry brandy and plum jam. So we helped ourselves to that, and also took quite a few prisoners. Again, by this day, we're getting so damn many prisoners that they were becoming a real problem. So then I was able to go up. There was a bit of a hill, and I was able to go up and dig in up on the hill. And there were a few sort of desultory, I wouldn't say they were attacks. They were just, I think they'd be described as counterattacks from the Germans, but I wouldn't quite put them in that category. I think they were a bit confused as to who we were and where we were and what we were. But you know, a few rounds of Bren gun fire, they seemed to scatter a bit. And then that evening, we were reinforced by C Company, and there was the following morning, if I remember correctly, there was a little bigger sort of counterattack, but it still wasn't forced. It wasn't put in with any zip, and it was easily beaten off. And in due course, the battalion was, they had taken Ajira, and the battalion was able to send up a carrier platoon to bring us out. So that was my first action.
How did you react to it afterwards? What did you feel?
Well, quite frankly, 40 years after, my only regret is that I never put that Piet Manium for a decoration. I'd written this thing up for General Kitching, who wanted to use it, and also for the battalion magazine. And that's my big regret, that this fellow, who, you know, pulled his damn Piet and fired it from the shoulder, standing up. At the time, I thought that was just normal. You know, I didn't know any better. I thought this was just a normal operation. It wasn't a normal operation at all. It was quite an abnormal operation. I thought it was just, you know, run of the mill, and this is what the regiment did every day, sort of. So, I don't think we had a casualty. It was, you know, we were just so lucky. Took all sorts of booty and prisoners, tanks knocked out. And the company commander got the DSO for that operation. I don't think he was ever within 10 miles of it. Mm-hmm. But he was killed in Ajira, so this was a posthumous thing they were able to give to him.
When were you given the Military Cross and Bar?
I was given, I the Military Cross
and Jumping ahead
for
here.
For the next operation. I really, you know, by the end of that, I really thought there was just routine stuff.
Yeah.
Well, the next operation, I guess, was I'm trying to think of the next one or not. Well, the next one that I was just directly involved. Well, we moved on from Ajira into the Salso River Valley, and the Salso. I have a painting in my study of the Salso River Valley, and. carried out a number of major flanking attack. Again, one of these things that we marched all night long, but we went as a battalion this time. And I was the company commander at that stage was Jim Stone, had taken over from Bury, who had been killed, as I mentioned. And we had a few pretty bitter skirmishes on the slopes, really, of what were Mount Etna. And all I can remember is that of this operation is that it was either 48 or 72 hours, and I remember the only thing I had to eat were raw eggs and raw potatoes, and a bit of vino. And that was how you kind of came out of that. I had a bit of hardtack and bully beef in my pack. But we pretty well had to live off the land in that case, because we were behind the lines and as a battalion, and it was some time before they could get supplies up to us by mule. It's hard to realize that the terrain was terrible, just terrible terrain. The thing I do remember, I don't think I've ever been so tired in my life as I was on that one. We marched through, infiltrate, you don't march, you kind of lead your platoon and you try to keep awake and not fall down, and all night long, up and down and up and down. And I don't think I've ever been so dog tired. And there was a type of very sort of open type of warfare went on. There was really no artillery or tank, no tank support. This was an infantryman show.
No way for tanks to move.
No way for tanks to move across. We had no artillery. We were beyond the range of artillery. So there it was. It was sort of infantry against infantry. And then, following on that, there was a number of major features. One of them was Hill 736. I can't remember the name of this mountain. And it was decided to attack this. This may have been before, I can't remember. But it was Hill 736. And this must have been before. No, it wasn't. It was after, because I was wounded. So this is after. And 15 and 16 platoons were placed